Good afternoon. You are listening to Inside Navy Supply. I am Russ Stewart, and it is a overcast day with storms on the horizon here aboard Naval Support Activity Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. We are recording in Building 309, headquarters for Naval Supply Systems Command, a global enterprise of more than 25,000 military and civilians who manage the Navy's end-to-end supply chain to sustain naval forces worldwide. Today on Inside Navy Supply, we have in the studio Dion English, Vice Admiral and Director for Logistics, J4, Joint Staff.
Hey, Russ, thanks for having me today. You talk about the overcast weather. I think it may be me. It seems like the last few weeks, everywhere I go, it's either overcast or raining. So blame it on me today.
Yeah, and it's also a Pennsylvania specialty. It's sunny during the week and cloudy and rainy on the weekends. We are going to be exploring today logistics and joint warfighting. But before we get started, I've got a couple of icebreaker questions to kind of reveal your personality and get to know you a little bit better.
I'm a little scared now, but let's do it.
So nice and easy. What is heavily played on your playlist right now?
Audible, a book. Mm-hmm. It's The End of the World is the Beginning by Peter Zeihan. And when I'm not, I listen to that on my way into work because I'm trying to get focused and get myself together. On my way from work, I'm celebrating the fact that I'm not at work. Mm-hmm. And so what's on that is probably a classic hip-hop playlist off of iTunes.
Yeah, it's always great to decompress after work and switch gears for when you hit the homestead. All right. Second and last question before we get to the meat of the episode. What is one vice you wish you could give up?
Sweets. I think if I'm addicted to anything, it's anything with sugar in it. And ironically, I've probably been trying to do without sweets now for the last couple months, but every time I see them, they call my name.
Yeah, and how about when you get to the office? People always bringing in their sweets and treats and going to a conference table and there's a bowl full of candy. It is hard to resist. I appreciate that a little bit as we warm up here. So, as Director for Logistics, J4, mm-hmm. Joint Staff, for our unindoctrinated audience, could you please maybe explain what the role of J4 is or the Joint Staff?
Okay. The Joint Staff serves to support the chairman in his role as primary military advisor to the Secretary of Defense, to the National Security Agency, and also to the President of the United States. And in that primary role, he's charged with providing best advice when it comes to military affairs and matters. And so as you look across the Joint Staff, we're divided into J codes that all represent an area of military specialty or military warfare. And so for me, I lead the office for logistics. Or joint logistics.
Perfect explanation. Thank you. So from your perspective as both a vice admiral on the Joint Staff, what does jointness truly mean in the context of modern warfare? Maybe how its definition has evolved throughout your career.
Yeah, that's a good question. Our ability to fight is usually tied to the changing character of war. And so what I mean by that, when we... You know, the first military skirmishes was probably nothing more sophisticated than people throwing rocks at each other. And then it evolved into arrows. Then it evolved into guns that did not have rifled barrels. And then once we inserted the rifling in the barrels, that changed the character of war. And then became mechanizations, tanks. And then came aircraft. With each innovation in warfighting, the character war changed. And so, ironically, now we're kind of at a period to where that the character war is changing again. And along with it has come the need to be a little bit better in fighting as a united force. And so we can go back to, I believe, the Goldwater-Nichols Act was enacted in 1986, 85 or 86. But it was the act that really sparked how we look at our Department of Defense through a joint warfighting lens. And it defined the role of the chairman as the principal military advisor to those three entities that I spoke of earlier. But it also redefined the roles of the joint chiefs, the service chiefs. And so prior to that, the service chiefs played a larger role into the military advice, but it was stovepipe. And that military advice was given according to how each service chief saw their role. And very seldomly did they come together in harmony to say, hey, well, there may be some strengths, or there, we may be able to leverage capabilities across services to get after the same thing. And so what that led to was an environment where sometimes you were competing for resources, and sometimes you were planning to attack the same target without talking to each service. And so because of this, as the character of war changed, we went from, you know, in the mid-1900s, looking at the air-land battle problem, where we focused on warfighting from the air and from the land. And later on in this century, we added the air-sea battle, because what it was trying to represent was the domains of warfare, air, land, and sea, the three primary areas that we have to be effective in. And because of that battle strategy, we were driven a little bit to be interoperable among the services. So Air Force and Navy, when it came to the air sea piece, Air Force and Army when it, and Marine Corps when it came to the land piece. And so that started forcing us to operate as a joint warfighting entity. And so now when you start taking a look at the problem set that we're facing, we have to be effective in more domains than just air, land, and sea. Because now we receive threats in the cyber area, which is now another domain, and we also receive threats from space. And when you take a look at how we are arrayed, especially when you take a look at our combatant commanders, we have an entire combatant commander dedicated to protecting the cyber environment. We have another combatant commander that's dedicated to the mission in space. We have a space force. And so when you look across services, our need to be effective in all those areas is going to drive us to operate together. Because when you operate together, not only can you gain efficiencies, but you get to be a little bit more effective by concentrating and having a lead service for one domain. So that's kind of the impetus for why we started being joint. But the evolution, in my opinion, has been driven by the changing character of war that changes the playing field from where the threats come from our adversaries on.
Awesome. That is a fantastic answer. And I like how you just really keyed into the inter-service cooperation across those domains. As we approach the Navy's 250th birthday, we celebrate those messages. Like for the Navy, we cover undersea, sea, air, and space. We cover all those domains, but mm-hmm. each of the services also owns a piece of those domains, and when we work together, we do better as a whole fighting force and can be better prepared for a myriad of adversaries. That leads us in kind of to my next question. In the area of great power competition, and you know, things are evolving and things are changing. The great power competition back in the 60s and 70s is different than it was in the 80s, and is different in what it is now or what it may become. How does an increased focus on joint warfighting better prepare the U.S. for potential conflicts with near-peer adversaries?
Yeah, that's a great question. When you look at where our threats come from, when you take a look at what's happening in Ukraine right now, it's primarily a land fight, but it's also dependent upon gaining superiority in the air. There's been activity that's happened at sea, and the collective effort from the adversaries and from and from the blue forces is around attaining access to one point. And so no longer do we have the luxury of depending on one force and saying, hey, we can do everything that we can from the ground. And so the advantages is as you integrate your warfighting tactics, your decisive outcomes are a little bit better because now you're leveraging the strengths from each area of warfare to get after a similar problem. And when we do that, it makes us a more formidable force.
Mm-hmm.
And that drives us not only to understand what we do and bring to the fight as a service, but we also have to understand what other services are doing and what their capabilities are and how those things integrate with each other.
Excellent. You know, some of the things that you're saying just make me think of other things in my experience. My father was a sailor.
Uh-huh.
Then I became a sailor. I did it for 20 years. And I can remember a time that the United States Navy was the only Navy on the planet who would both launch and recover aircraft at night.
Yeah.
And foul weather. We were the only ones that could do that kind of thing. And nowadays, I think that what we can do and what others cannot do extends across the service, including our jointness, the way we train and to cooperate with one another. We're very intentional about that. So I have a bit of a head scratcher for you.
Okay.
This is going to make you think for a second. As a senior logistician, what is a less obvious benefit that would come from a truly integrated joint logistics enterprise? I mean, the obvious ones are out there,
yeah.
Better capabilities, better warfighting, et cetera. But what's something that's that people may not be aware of?
That is a good question. The one thing that I look at is when we look at how we solve problems and how we work toward integrating new technologies into our way of doing business. So take advanced manufacturing. So right now, advanced manufacturing is one of those capabilities that we know that we all need, that we all can benefit from. And you have, right now, you have each service chasing how to incorporate advanced manufacturing into their supply chain scenarios, because on the surface it makes really good sense. If I can produce things at point of need, that saves me demand on airlift, sea lift. It definitely will reduce production lead time for an item, and it gives you a forward position capability that enables the warfighter, that increases readiness, that also increases operational availability. And so every service has thought about this, and every service is getting after it in different ways. And so when I talked earlier about why Goldwater Nichols was put into place, it was to kind of have someone to be the orchestra conductor. And so I think one of the less obvious benefits is if you have someone who's, for lack of a better word, conducting the orchestra on the chase for technological advancement and incorporation into our processes, what that allows is in each area, you develop centers of excellence based on your problem set. And it, the old adage of a rising tide raises all boats, now you have the collective ability to get after a problem together. And you don't stifle your thinking. You just let the people who are strong in one area have that problem. And you federate that process across the services. And now you come out with a better capability that we all can and need. And so here's the other piece. So, and I hate to keep harping on the advanced manufacturing capability, but if I have an Army advanced manufacturing cell positioned forward, that all I had to do was provide the drawings, the capability, and the raw materials to produce a Navy part, we all benefit. And if that part can be produced at point of need, closer to where we need it. Who cares if it's an Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, Space Force, advanced manufacturing, 3D printer? What we care about is the ability to leverage those things in different locations. And so for us to be truly agile, truly resilient, and truly responsive in our collective supply chains, the ones that we manage in our services, I think it's going to be incumbent upon us to take a look at what the other services are doing. The other piece is, to that question, is the demand. So the demand signal that we send to the industrial base for that need. If it's a combined joint requirement that is being fielded, that's being advocated and funded by collective services, that gives you greater buying power, that gives you greater positioning inside commercial industry to solve some of these same problems.
Wow. All right. Very illuminating answer. And I think perhaps a lot of people forget we all get stovepiped. You've mentioned that before. We get blinders on. We focus on what's happening in our service and what we're trying to do, but we neglect to look across the services and see where what I'm working on over here benefits the other services in similar areas. You know, it's, and at the risk of sounding trite, it's the one team, one fight.
Yeah,
we may wear different uniforms, but our customer is the United States, and that's who we work for in the end.
Yeah. Or, you know, it's almost like, Russ, it's almost like going to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
If you're sick and you're going to the doctor, you really don't care if that doctor is Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, Space Force, Coast Guard. You just want a doctor that can solve your problem.
Amen.
And so when we start thinking in those terms, does it really matter how the problem is solved? Or who's the problem solver? What really matters is how the problem is solved.
Is it any easier to cross those borders when you're say stationed someplace like the Pentagon, where you're co-located, versus in a base or installation where there's only one service?
That's a good question. I would say yes. I mean, just by nature of my organization, we're joint.
Mm-hmm.
In my front office, I have Navy, Marine, and Army, and a civilian. But on my floor, we cover all services with the exception of Space Force. And we're trying to get a Space Force person down there. Right now, Air Force does a lot of Space Force logistics work. But it's definitely easier in the building. All you got to do is walk out in the hallway, and you will see someone from the other services. And you know where the other service headquarters are. And then we're frequently put in meetings to where we have to talk and negotiate and discuss with each other. In that building, though, the biggest thing is most people are working on their budget,
mm-hmm.
their inputs, and how they build their own force. And I think that every service is looking to balance the money that they're going to get, that they're going to be allocated to field the service that the Navy needs or the service that the nation needs versus the one that they can afford. And so sometimes we have budgetary limitations that cap how far we innovate or how far we go. And so when you want to take a look at the need and the ability to have those people in the same spot to talk and collaborate on capabilities, the idea of if we're looking for a capability, if I don't own it, then maybe there's another service with the same interest in it. And we do that in our logistics functional capabilities board when we take a look at how services are trying to fill new capabilities as logistics enablers. And so that meeting comes together, and it naturally brings together all services to say, okay, what are you trying to put on the table? And you quickly get to identify where folks are shooting on the same target or why they're trying to feel the same capability and say, okay, hey, if we look at this through the research and development process, through the rapid fielding and innovation piece, we have a lot better advantage if we present this requirement as a joint requirement than we do as a single service. So that environment, just being there, even though the Pentagon is huge and there's several people in there, the proximity does that. I think out in the field, it depends on where you are. You know, if you're in a fleet concentration area, most of the time there is at least a couple other services there with you. But a lot of it really comes down, in my opinion, to relationships, building relationships with one with people in other services, but especially people who do the same thing you do in other services, because you can learn a lot from them and they can also learn a lot from you.
That's an enlightening answer. One of the things I kind of took away from that, it, you know, as each of the services endeavors to get the most bang for its dollar, I see that it almost sounded like if my service doesn't necessarily have the resource, the free resources to put on this thing, there may be another service who has those free resources to be able to put on that that effort, that line of effort.
Yeah. And it starts with a question I frequently ask is, what problem are we trying to solve?
Mm-hmm.
And so if we take a look at the delivery of goods and supplies to an area, you can have a scenario to where things are flown into a port by an Air Force heavy lift plane, moved by a truck, by an Army truck, to a port, loaded on a ship that's contracted by Navy, driven to another port, and offloaded, Army gear, to say it's Army gear on that ship. It goes to another port, offloaded by Marine Corps stevedores or Army stevedores. And in that, every service has owned a little piece of that problem. But the what we are trying to solve piece is the delivery of goods and supplies to a forward location.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of goes back to that doctor thing I told you about. You know, when you're on the receiving end of those things and you need those things, you don't care what service the doctor come from. You don't care what service the solution come from. You just want the solution to work. And so in my opinion, if we start looking at the problem set, especially when it revolves around funding advocacy, and limited funding in certain areas, but when we look at it from the angle of what problem are we trying to solve, I think it will help us, become a more joint and united and integrated force moving forward. And some of that work is happening now. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Yeah. As I mentioned here earlier, Naval Supply Systems Command manages the Navy's in supply chain, and sitting at the J4, you're worried about getting us all integrated, that end-to-end logistics.
Yeah.
Well, talking about logistics and joint warfighting, what advice would you give to junior officers or enlisted personnel entering their careers, particularly regarding the importance of understanding and embracing joint operations?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think back to my journey to being a joint officer, and the Navy didn't always value being joint. Going to War College, JPME, kind of wasn't a thing. We used to be able to get a waiver for being joint for flag, and so once they took away that waiver, then people started caring about it. So I remember as an 04, I was at a roadshow, Supply Corps roadshow. And the captain that was OP at the time was briefing this new direction that people were going. It was like, hey, there's going to be no more waivers for flag. Joint is going to be a thing. And so in my head, at that point as an 04, there was no way in the world that I considered myself to be in the Navy long enough to be a flag officer. But what I did look at was, hey, the Navy and the military is going in this direction toward being joint. And so for my next set of orders, when I was leaving, I went to the Navy War College to learn about this joint stuff. And then at the reason that I was doing it, because I wanted to make sure that as I was building my toolkit of experiences, that was one thing that I was adding to it. I didn't know any better at the time. And then as I went to my first joint job and got to work with other services, I started seeing the value of it, because sometimes other services solve problems a little bit differently than we do. And sometimes it's better. And so bringing those minds together, bringing those cultures together, which really it is, and learning from each other, I think is good. But for the junior people, what I would say is always kind of pull your head up and look at the environment that we're in and look and see where the military is going. Now, our community does a pretty good job of highlighting what's valued in our community values brief that we do, in the convening orders that they have for boards, and in the precepts that they have for boards. But there's also looking at the environment. Like right now, you know, I talked about the changing character of war, which now has us playing more in the digital age, more in the cyber area. AI and machine learning is becoming a thing. So my advice is say, hey, look at what's happening on the transformational edge of the services and DoD, and see how are you positioning yourself, particularly if your horizon is 10 to 15 years out from where you are. How are you positioning yourself to understand that skill and incorporate it if it's something that you think is going to make the community and make you a better asset to the Navy and to the Joint Force? It's like the old adage that Wayne Gretzky had. He said he never really tried to skate to where the puck was. He tried to go to where the puck was going. Hmm. And so as young people coming up, you all are not as embedded in the old way of doing things as we are. You know, if you come in and you move this piece of paper in front of me, I'm going to question why it's moved. Mm-hmm. So younger people, and I sound really old when I say this, but are more resilient and less resistant to change than folks who've been in an organization for 100 years and they, we got to do it this way. Mm-hmm. And so what I would tell you, whether you're young or old, spend some time examining where the organization goes. And if you aren't changing with the organization, you may find yourself in trouble. I think Jack Welch, when he was at GE, said, if the rate of change inside an organization is slower than the rate of change outside an organization, you're doomed for failure. And so from a personal perspective, as you're planning your career, I think you need to take a look at it. I'm not saying run off on a wild goose chase on something that nobody's going to value. You probably need to do a calm and calculated approach to what you're doing. But you got to always be aware of where the puck is going and where the rate of change is going.
Right. And it's been said that, you know, in many counselors there is much wisdom. So don't forget your mentors. Don't forget those folks who can speak truth into your life on the areas where you're weak and build upon the areas where you're strong. Sounds like we need to maintain our flexibility and maintain vision, not only for your short-term goals, but your long-term goals as well. We, in order to keep this as timely, we are at the end of our program, and in a very brief statement, in a succinct way to put it, if you had one thing you wanted our listeners to remember, if they remembered nothing else, what do you want them to take away from their time with Inside Navy Supply?
I think this is a good forum to kind of listen to what senior leaders are thinking. And so my one thing is, I would say, as you listen to advice, as you listen to information taken in, you don't have to accept all of it as truth. But I would say examine and see how it applies to your life. And do the same thing in your mentoring relationships. If you don't have a mentor, you're probably in trouble. But understand that those mentors are going to give you advice based probably about 90% on their own experiences. And understand that. I mean, don't discount it because you think the person is biased. But what I would say is compare it to information that you get. And in this podcast and this platform is just one other source that we can utilize to make ourselves better. So thank you for allowing me to talk to you and talk to whoever is going to listen to this.
Well, Admiral, we sincerely appreciate your time. You know, I know you've got a crazy schedule, and we've been exploring logistics and joint warfighting with Vice Admiral Dion English, and we're going to wrap this up, and I appreciate you all listening to Inside Navy Supply. Over and out.